session number 13391, wheel number 3.
Park Rail 3.
Those aircraft there which had come in the misfogging sensible, and you would never thought they would ever land. Those great holes in the fuselage, those wings hanging off nearly, it's incredible. And so we left the fitters there to do the job, and we came back to Hull. And I said to Benny, I should tell him stories of Hull Street in the barracks on the right in the room. I said, "No, you heard these stories, Benny. You're going to see the reality." So we called at the Crown and had a drink, and I took a bottle of beer for Mother, and we called at the top of the street and had fish and chips. And in come Mrs. Slater. Well, she'd never been washed since midwife washed her, and she had black greasy hair hanging down here, and teeth hung out to dry, and yellow skin. And she stood there with a jug of beer, and Benny said, "That's the highlights of my career, seeing her." And then we stayed there. The next morning, we ran the lorry, which would come in. We ran it uptown, at back of the Cecil Cinema, and so we just stuck it there. And the next morning, we went and swept the snow off it. And away we went, no bother at all. Went back up. We'll compare that with, I was playing darts in the Blue Bell in Finningley, one night, my lads. And in come Yankee sergeants and two others, and they had leather jerkins. On the back of one was a target for tonight, a lass in a bikini and all this, all painted on. And he said to me, "Corporal, do you know where Finningley is?" I said, "Well, yeah, it's stationed there, just a mile up the road." He said, "Could we go? Could you take us?" I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, they've got one of our pilots' bodies being killed, you see, and we had to pick it up." So I said, "All right, yeah. I said, "Do you want a pint? Got a game of darts?" He said, "Oh no, we've been travelling, I think it was at Northcote, so couldn't we, travelling all these hours and one thing or another." I said, "The man's dead. With your respect, he's dead. There's nothing you can do for him. Have a drink, play a game of darts. He'll still be there." They didn't. And so I said, "All right."
Why dare they not?
Well, it's the American rigidity of their, you see. And so I said to the landlady, I had my two children with me then. So I said, "Will you look after them while I go?" I said, "Yeah, all right, George." And so off we went. So when I got to Finningley, the body had gone. They'd taken to Rosington, another satellite place.
Rosington.
He'd gone there, I think. And so I said to him, they said, "Could we get petrol?" I said, "Yes." So I got hold of the orderly officer and I said, "Will you see these lads get filled up?" I said, "Oh, yeah." So they filled him with petrol. And I said, what about somebody to eat?" "Oh, no. I said, no. I said, "Oh, come in." And with the number one cook in the RAF, a chap called Childs, and marvellous. And our cookhouse was peacetime built, you know, still there. And everything was polished and neat, and the tables were polished, the oak tables, and the little eyes dropped. And I said, "The sergeant, because this time we get up about 10 at night," I said, "Hey, because in the RAF was always night flying, so it was always up." I said, "Will he see to these lads, get them some coffee?" And so he said, "Yes." Well, I said, "Don't bother." I said, "You're all right, oh, you're all right." Got coffee and sausages and left them then, he said. And they said, "The difference. Now, if that had been English blokes," they said, "Why, all right," you see. They really think, what can he do with him? He's dead, he's gone. And they would have found some excuse, you know. And I was talking once to, when I was on another course, and this chap was, he'd fought in the First World War. He was a flyer in the RAF, in the old Royal Flying Corps. And he said, "The difference between the Germans and ourselves is," the Germans, that would react immediately to anything. He said, "But the British, if you went to said, hey, the Germans have landed, they'd say, are they? They're going to have a look first. Are they? They're going to have a look. But he said, the difference is the Germans work through discipline. And to show you this, wherever he's retired now, but he worked with the city, he was a prisoner of war, very nice fella, Cal Coffin. And so when was working the town restoring Queen's Gardens, the engineer, who was an ex-major, and the others all at the army, was busy having a little chat about army, mostly funny things, particularly about women. And so we said to Kurt, hey Kurt, tell us something about the German army. There must have been some blooming humorous time, the German army. And the only thing he said was, they caught one of their men pinching out the barrack room, out with mates, and the whole regiment was paraded to see him shot. And that's the difference. And there was one famous occasion when the officer went mad and he ordered his regiment to march over a cliff, which they refused to do, and so they disarmed him, but the whole regiment was punished for not obeying orders. He said, and this is the difference, the British armed forces believe in firmness with kindness, you see, and this is one of the differences in national attitudes they get. And you get this similar difference if you're at the, you know, the Comet, the aircraft, the Comet.
Yes.
It was the first jet. Well, then the pilot was, I remember the pilot was saying, when he went around demonstrating this, they were trying to sell it to the Turks. Now, the Yanks had one of their kites coming in, and he just flew by it twice before he landed. He just flew by and then landed to it. And when he was walking, he knew those commander and those two officers, American officers, and he could hear these hurried footsteps coming in, and they caught up with him and asked him why he should do this, you know, really regimental. And it's one of the difference, but if you'll notice, it still goes on in the service, still goes on.
Can you tell me more about these common graves that were dug for the victims of the raids?
No, because by then I'd been called into the Air Force, so then I couldn't tell you after that, because then the bombing came more and more frequent, and we had, fittingly there, we could see it happening in Hull. And the thing is, you're thinking about your family.
This is about 40 miles?
Oh, yeah, you could see it. They're the flashes and one another. So it's flat, isn't it? It's flat. And
Can you tell me when you were in Hull for the raids and when you were in the RAF away?
I was called up to, it would be 41. 41, end of 41, 42. So I was in the first lot of raids, and was in the, when the first, before the war, the ARP, in fact, when the first, you know, everybody had a siren sounded, as soon as war was declared, there in London.
On the 3rd of September.
The whole country had this alert, it was just like. Well, I was busy sticking notices up to the air raid shelter in town, in Story Street, and that notice was there for many, 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 many years, till about the late 70s, I think. It was still on that wall, to the air raid shelters, and but then it come on to the sudden the blackout, and then another thing which happened was the Guildhall. We all had to be issued with identity cards, and all had our photographs, because we had the official photographer with us, and Jim Breyer, he's another Quaker, and we all had our photos taken, a little card, so we could go in. Well, again, we're English, you see. So how long did that last? 5 minutes? You see, for a while, you had to flash your card, and it's, well, stupid, you see. You see, unless something's absolutely imminent, people get blasé, don't they? And this is it. And even in the service, when I was at Finnerley, with one queer fella who couldn't, he didn't want to be in anyway, couldn't go there. And he was supposed to be on guard at headquarters. The group captain fell over him, he was fast asleep on the floor. See, and he get this the spirit, but the main thing in all that war was determination not to be beaten.
We haven't said very much about the work of the emergency services in Hull, like the fire brigade and so on. Did they perform well or not?
Well, they did. There was the heavy rescue group, which a friend of mine was in that. Now, they had the job of, you know, heavy rescue. But again, in Hull, there wasn't the same trouble as you would have got, shall we say, in Glasgow or Belfast, where they have, where no, oh, not many, we no high-rise flats. Then we built a lot since, but we hadn't then. There was no very big houses. The main ones are on the Beverly Road, and they escaped quite a lot of it. But the rest of it was simply terrace-type housing. And so the resultant heap of rubbish was not as big as you would get in when you got high-rise flats. So their job was made. And plus the fact that we had no cellars. So you can't have a cellar in Hull. And to see this, we Joe Biglin was in charge of the pier and that for the corporation, and was do you remember the big flood in 56, was it?
53,
somewhere around that big flood, that's right.
The big North Sea tide.
That's it. Well, when we was coming around Queen's Gardens, they'd moved Wilberforce's statue, you know, and put him in Queen's Gardens. And then it sank, the road sank, so it formed like a dip. And as we came across, Joe said, "Look at that." And there was water jetting up from the cracks of the concrete, about 3 feet. He said, "And they expect me to build an underground car park in Prince's Dock." He said, and this is the great difficulty.
But you were telling me about the emergency services in Hull.
Yeah. Well, you see, that's it. So the heavy rescue had a probably a lighter job than what the one of another city, but it's still a bit horrendous. And after the war, I was talking to a friend of mine who had the deputy city engineer, Mr. Anderton, was with him, was building a little site up there near the bridge. We only lost one bridge during the war, that was in South Coast Lane. And they were building there, and he was telling him that these were the bomb craters were left by these. So Jim said, "I was within every rescue." So he didn't say any more. So their job was a bit grim. They had to get the bodies out and rescue them the best they can. And so they were all right. And then the fire service, brothers in the fire service, now when they bombed the flour mills, you know, Ranx's flour mill on the river, Swan Flour Mill, he was there, and he had a job to run out the blocks. And said, "Oh no, wait a bit, the bombs falling," before they run out the rails. He said, "Not all risking their lives all the time." But this is the job, everybody, whatever they did. It's another thing about the English character as well, which you find that if whatever a person is, whether it's you or I or anybody else, we expect them to be that. And the fire service expect to be firemen. And you find this in other cultures, it doesn't work that way, like the States and all that kind of thing. We don't expect a Methodist minister going to a betting shop. We don't. Each one of us, whatever it is expected to do what he's supposed to do. And he gets no sympathy if he doesn't do it. But other people, they kind of blur these edges, don't they? And you just notice in the press and abroad and that, the difference. And this is everybody, if he's an able man, he's got to do what the job calls for, and that's it. So we, as I say, with the city engineer, with no, apart from listening to that, with no contacts with this is because that was their job. Heavy rescue was their job. Our job was to go out and probably measure up and other things and carry on. And so he kept this, and our job wasn't the fire service. It was your life was looking after yourself within that circuit. Were you all right? Were your neighbours all right?
But did the fire service always succeed in putting the fires out, or were they left burning for days?
Well, whether could have put them out, but I have a book, and I wish I'd have looked for it. It was the official record of that. Now, Ranks, just you know, the North Bridge, when you go on Drapool Bridge, Ranks had a big mill there. Well, when that went, half the grain went in the river. Well, that was smouldering for probably weeks and months.
The mill?
The mill was demolished, but you can't get at the wheat once it gets hold of that. It's an internal fire. But otherwise, they'll be put out within reason.
What was this bridge on Southcote's Lane that was hit?
It's a road. It's been put back as it was. It came one night, did Jerry, and he tried to bomb every bridge. North Bridge, Drapool Bridge, something around it. It was coming to demolish the communications. But the only one that did shift was that one over the railway down Southcote's Lane. The others they missed. You see, with all due respect to bombing, we discovered this in the when they brought the tall boy out, these earthquake bombs, and they tried to bomb a railway. I think it was in Belgium or France. They never hit it. It was an overhead kind of thing, but they went there to it, shook it all summer to hit it exactly. So when you're up there dropping this thing from, say, whatever it was, 10,000, 30,000, despite all your mathematics, it doesn't behave exactly to get to a point, because your aircraft travelling at feet a second, aren't they? Travelling. So the exact second when to release that bomb to go of that curve and to hit that precise spot.
Did you think that the barrage balloons and the anti-aircraft sites did a good job?
Oh, they did. They kept the aircraft up. That was their job. They wanted to bring them down. It was to keep them up. So they brought in the 4.7s later on, and there was these batteries. There was one on the race course out here, the Edna Aerodrome. One on there.
A race course in Hull?
Oh, yes, didn't know with a race course. Well, it's where it closed before my day. It was the Hedden race course. It's still there, the land.
In the village of Hedden?
It's on Eden Road. On Eden Road, it's near Eden. And it was, so they're telling me, the only race course in the country with a straight mile. Flat.
But
straight.
There was an AA site on it.
Oh, after the, yes. The reason it failed in the late Edwardian period, I think, the early Georgian period, was that Hull, again, was on a limb. So if you had race horses, you didn't want to have to carry them all here and then all that way back. Where you couldn't move them from one course to another, and so on, and that was probably. And again, you see, we had no really rich. But you want rich people for racing. You want the Aga Khan and people like that for racing. Well, we hadn't got them. You see, and then another thing. This was a great Methodist city, so the Ranks wouldn't be expected to go racing, would they?
The Ranks.
The Ranks family.
Were they Methodists?
Your rank was a great Methodist, yes. They built Queen's Hall, which is now gone, of course.
Where else do you remember anti-aircraft sites?
I can't remember the others. They were dotted, the West Hull, they were dotted round the outer perimeter of Hull. So they had a right thump, you could hear them thumping. Another strange thing which happened. When my children was this working friend of mine, they lived down East Park Avenue on Aulnes Road. Now, as I was going there, on the top of East Park, it's still there, it was Northgard Motors. The shop is still there. I think it's still a motor shop anyway. But that was a kind of headquarters for the type of home guard or whatever there was there. And as I was walking down, and there was a raid on, And then a lady said to me, would I, she says, can I walk with you? She was, there was the Mallet Lambert School, which is still there. My daughter went to Mallet Lambert. It was also Civil Defence Headquarters, and she was going to man that. And she said, would you mind if I walked with you? So I said, oh, by all means. So I walked with her over East Park and over that bridge. And when we got over the bridge, we saw something come down, looked like a parachute. Something come down like a parachute. So when I'd seen her safely across, and I could have blown up the school, there was nobody to stop and just walk in. Astonishing, there's nobody about. And then I came back and I thought, I'd look around. So there was a WAF manned balloon barrage just at the end of the boating lake. And I went down, and unfortunately there was a WAF officer. And so I was accused of being looking after the WAFs. I was threatened to put on a charge for chasing the WAFs, like, and I thought, God, stone the crows. And I came back and I went to this other headquarters, but that was equally futile. So what that was, I never discovered. But we definitely saw something coming down during the raid. And you get these little things that happened in the war.
When you were in Hull during the raids, did you use the public air raid shelter?
No, we had our own.
An Anderson shelter?
That's it, right. Well, no, it was a brick. The brick, you see. And we put in... the beds in, you know, put in beds. And then I remember it with Audrey, she got a bit hysterical, had to clip along the air raid on. And I was outside, and the wife had this shrapnel rattling down and shouting at me because she thought I'd been it. Well, because it could have been, you see, you don't think, you just got to stand outside. But after a while, we stayed in bed. When I came on leave, I also sometimes stay in bed, sometimes sleep on the floor. And I was laid on the floor when one of the last raids, they dropped a landmine in the field nearby. It's now at the school there. And a big crack ran across the ceiling while it was going right across. And then on the very last raid, when they had this Savoy, it came across and it was cannon fire, and it just missed our house, but it hit the one opposite, just the ridge tiles, to go the ridge tiles up. But that was as near as we ever got. There was just a bit there, and there's houses damaged on the estate and everything else. But if it wasn't you, we see. Well, what happened in the beginning, when I got called up, then you had to leave your wife and children to the... And then the neighbours used to help, you see. Perhaps they're going for company, going to one another's shelters for company. And we said, well, when he got it... night after night, there was 80 positive raids, but there was dozens of false alarms. It gets very wearing when you're up all night and have to go to work next day. It takes, but and you wonder now how people stood it in that sense. There, night after night, the alarm used to go, and you used to get up and get in the shelter, wait and wait and wait and. You probably hear them going over, they're probably going over to somewhere else, to Sheffield or wherever they're going. And then found the old clear, go maybe 3 or 4 or 5 in the morning. And back there, and a cup of tea, and then off to work again.
But this really relates to the objective of strategic bombing.
Oh,
to
yes,
undermine the morale of the workers in a country.
Yeah.
Do you think it did make people say... well, we ought to give in or
come
to an agreement.
By no means. Oh, no. No.
Even though they were tired and...
No, the thing is that it strengthened you, anyway. Get your own back.
Did people want revenge on the Germans?
Not revenge. They wanted them beaten, but not revenge. There wasn't that... in fact, the reason... So they tell me, I can't speak with authority on this, but they tell me one of the reasons why Montgomery was not allowed to take Berlin, he could have done it, And so was the fact that the Russians had suffered horribly at the hands of the Germans and the Americans, you see, and the American Jewish interests. They let them take it, and the reason was that they said if they let the British take it, they would be too kind to the Germans. You see, when they first went in, plenty of my mates was in that effort. When they first went in, there was no fraternisation, especially when they discovered Belsen. They discovered there was no fraternisation, but that rapidly went. It rapidly went, and quite a number married German girls and brought them across here. But, and so, if they'd have gone into Berlin, there wouldn't have been all that trouble later on.
But didn't the people who had lost relatives and so on in the bombing, and who having been subjected to the bombing in Hull, feel that the Germans ought to get a taste of their own medicine?
Well, they got it. They got it with interest.
They did. That was the decision of the government. But yeah. What was the feeling of the population in Hull about that the Germans should get some in return?
Well, it wasn't been. They decided, said that it would, when he said they would get it all back, and they did. I mean, we manned all the factories and the women in the factories. We went as armourers. We went to a factory making bullets, and they said to us, "If you can, tell the lassies they're doing a good job." There's one section there which is partly interesting, that all the girls in that were deaf because the noise was so terrific. They had deaf people.
Was this in Hull?
No, this was in a war factory somewhere around Donny, I think.
And you mean they deliberately employed people who were already deaf?
Deaf, that's right. Because the noise of the machine was so deafening. And one of the girls, her job was to these were 303 they were producing, small outfit. And if she saw one little thing wrong with it, like whip it out, just watching these bullets flash by hour after hour after hour. And so they said to us, if you tell them they're doing a good job, they'll take it. It's not just telling them, they don't believe us. And so we did. And oh, they were delighted. Particularly this as armors, of course, was using it, and they were quite delighted. So all these factories were manned throughout the country. There was, when, to give you that, when I was, after I'd done my training and I was posted to Finningley, and when he went, you know about army discipline, the rest of it, but when he went to Finningley, there was SPs on the gate, special police, Air Force police. And if you were there after hours, they would get you a mug of tea, and they would see you to your billet. And one of them was telling me, he said, you know, he was trained at Uxbridge, was the military police training camp, and there they had to scrub their bed with toothbrushes. Discipline was absolutely it. So when he came post to Finningley, one chap came, whatever he'd done was wrong. And so they put him on a charge. So the next day, the flight sergeant said to him, Corporal, you've got this man on a charge. He said, yes, he said. Have I made the form out wrong? He said, no, it's quite all right. He said, is he a friend of yours? No, I said, I don't know the man. He said, but if I was yours, you'd go there and scrub it. He said, well, what's wrong? He said, we're on good terms with the lads here. We don't do that kind of thing.